This year, the Jarrod Company is celebrating its 250th birthday since John Jarrod opened a small shop in Woodbridge in 1770. Carolyn Wood talks to Caroline Jarrod, who delves into the remarkable history behind today's thriving business.
Caroline, thank you very much for taking some time this afternoon to talk to me about the early history and heritage of Jarrod's. You haven't always been in Norwich, I don't think.
No, we started off in Woodbridge in 1770 with the first John Jarrod. And he, I'm one of the seventh generation, so we go back quite a long way. He started off as a sort of grocer and draper, I think, in Woodbridge. Sometimes it's a bit difficult to be exactly precise about what people were doing at that time. So he founded the business in 1770. He then sadly died in 1773, so, and his young son was taken by his mother to Norwich, so that was where the Norwich connection originally started. But young John Jarrod, he was apprenticed to somebody called, with the wonderful name of Obadiah Silcock in Stalham, who I think had a similar type of shop to the shop that was still owned by the family in Woodbridge, but it had been let out to somebody else. And he went through his apprenticeship and then eventually decided to go back to Woodbridge and take up the reins of his father's business. So that continued for some time then, and he was obviously quite entrepreneurial. He had very good reports from his from Obadiah, who was his mentor, I think, as well as just as being his employer. And he was obviously quite entrepreneurial, young John. And when he went back to Woodbridge, he then, after a while, he decided that he would diversify somewhat. And it was the time of the Napoleonic Wars, and he decided to buy a farm because the grain prices were very high because grain couldn't be shipped in from Europe. So he went into farming. He then, after the Napoleonic Wars, the grain prices dropped, and he decided to, around that time, to go into printing with his brother-in-law. So it was a sort of fortuitous relationship, really. And so he started printing. And he also liked a bit of publishing, so he was publishing sermons from, I suppose, dissenting ministers, really. He was very involved with the nonconformist movement, so and looking after the lot of the poor. And so I think that was partly why he got into publishing as well as printing. He then, actually quite late on really in his life, he was 53 when he decided that he wanted to go to a larger centre of population, and by this time he had four sons, and the oldest was about 20 or so at that point, and he came up to Norwich with the eldest son with £7,000 in cash, which was quite a lot at that time. Deposited it with Gurney's Bank, which was one of the predecessor banks to Barclays Bank. So he was very much sort of making his mark, somebody coming to Norwich to establish a new business. And he took on a property in, we're not sure exactly where it was, but I think it was around London Street, or sort of opposite where the store is at the moment. So this was 1823. And set himself up there as a printer, publisher and bookseller, and gradually developed the business, particularly with his eldest son, but then the other three sons started to come into the business as well. In 1840, they decided to move across the road to the existing corner site, really. So we've been on that site, which is familiar to many people in Norwich since that time. It was a relatively small part of the site then, but over the years, the company acquired more and more of the site. Particularly at that time in 1838, we got some lovely diagrams actually of showing that the different parts of that ground plot in that area which they bought. So that meant that they could, they had the printing and the retail and publishing were all on the same site at that point. The business worked sort of very well from there. It was quite constrained, I think, by the site, and eventually they've in subsequent generations they moved the printing works down to the Whitefriars area. So they then developed the retail site more and more at the beginning of the 20th century.
And the Printers was a huge employer in Norwich at that point, I think.
Yes, it was. It was it grew to be a very significant printing company. And I think there were probably lots of relatively small jobbing printers around at that time, and probably quite a few of them also published. But in the middle of the 19th century, Gerald started publishing more seriously. This was with the, really the third generation developing that, and they had a publishing house in London, they had offices in London, publishing a lot of educational books. So Brewer was one of their authors who wrote books about science. They also published household tracts, which went back to what I was talking about earlier with trying to improve the lots of some ordinary people.
With the temperance movement.
Yes, and tying in with the temperance movement as well. And they were also involved in setting up the ragged schools in Norwich. Samuel, who was the second brother in the third generation, he was one of the first people in Norwich to sign the temperance pledge. And he was obviously very keen on that, and they got involved in the anti-slavery movement. And Norwich had this tremendous tradition of sort of non-conformism, and they were very much part of that, with the probably better known families such as the Gurneys and the Colemans and others. So I think Norwich must have been a fascinating place at that time, sort of quite an intellectual hotbed, I would have thought, and people really wanting to improve the lot of the general populace.
But they also, I think, published a much-loved children's book
We
probably all remember growing up with.
Well, it's interesting you describe it as a children's book, because it wasn't originally intended as a children's book. The story there was that there was a lady called Mary Sewell who wrote for Gerald's, who she wrote some of the household tracts that I was talking about earlier, and she got to know the brothers quite well, and she said, oh, would you be interested in publishing this little thing that my daughter's written? And Anna Sewell had been, who's her daughter, she had an accident when she was quite young, and she couldn't walk very well, so she was very reliant on horse-drawn carriages or vehicles to get her around. And she felt very strongly that horses were poorly treated. There was a particular device called a bearing rein, which was fixed to the horse's bit, which goes in its mouth, and it was to force their heads down all the time. And she obviously observed quite a few horses which had not been treated well. So it was really a story told from the point of view of a horse to show how poorly horses have been treated, and really try to get people to think about that and treat them better. So it wasn't intended as a children's book. It was much more
about... We're talking about Black Beauty.
Yes, exactly, yes. Sorry. But it went on to be phenomenally successful. But it was the only book that Anna Sewell actually wrote, because she died not long after its publication, but she did see it published. But initially, a bit of a risk on publishing it, and the booksellers weren't particularly interested in it, but it obviously captured the imagination, and then it's never been out of print. The copyright ran out, and then Gerald's didn't have any involvement with it, really, after the mid-1920s. But it's always been a very strong bestseller, and many, many, many different editions of it, and enduringly popular.
Anything else that's notable within the printing works?
Well, I suppose the most notable thing is that my grandfather, who was the only member of the fifth generation to work within the company, he was quite a sort of polymath, really, but he was very interested in technology, and he felt very strongly that you should be able to produce good colour images from 35mm transparencies, as opposed to the much larger format cameras that are being used in the past. So 35mm cameras are much, much more portable than the larger format cameras. So it may sound a bit dry, but he had technologists here on the site who work with him to try to get a better print quality from that, and that did change the economics of print. So he was very keen on the quality, but also using these 35mm transparencies to actually generate the print. So what that meant was that we printed a lot of the holiday guides for resorts all around the country in the early days. So there would be sort of Bournemouth, Rhyl, Llandudno, Cromer, Yarmouth, all sorts of places. So that was something where they developed a real niche. And then on the back of that, we developed a new publishing business, which was what many people sort of probably 20 years ago would have known Jarrells for in the rest of the country, was publishing calendars and postcards and holiday guides. So that was quite a breakthrough, but we were also very high quality printers and printed a great breadth of different types of publications, from Good Housekeeping and Vogue magazines, printed massive industrial catalogues, which were on very thin paper, which again was something which technologically quite difficult. And the Dairy Diary, which would be familiar to many people because it was delivered by the milkman, so that was very long print runs. We used to print lots of the road atlases and lots of books for people like Reader's Digest and the Doc Hessian Gardening Experts series. So quite far-reaching printers. Alongside that, the publishing side developed. They were separate divisions, so but people often get confused between printing and publishing. But we did produce a lot of holiday guides through the publishing division. And also the very popular Pathfinder walking guides with the Ordnance Survey. And Timpson's England with John, much loved John Timpson from Radio 4's Today programme. That was quite a breakthrough book in terms of a sort of pictorial armchair travel, I suppose, to the UK. Mm-hmm. So over the years, there were quite a few things which were probably landmarks in their own right and are well known generally. But of course, nowadays, people know the company much more from the retail side, which was developing in parallel, and was very much a sort of core part of the business with the three different divisions.
And what was the next developments during the early 20th century?
Well, going back to the early 20th century, I suppose at that time you had the fourth generation involved, who were two brothers. And they probably concentrated mostly on the printing side, but they were quite ambitious in developing the company. Each generation sort of brought its own flavour to the development of the company, really. And what was interesting looking back was we produced a book last year to coincide with our 250th anniversary, but was looking at the time span that each of the generations had actually overseen the company, and usually it's sort of 30 or 40 years, so that's in terms of what happens in that time, it's quite significant. But the two brothers, William and Herbert, who were in charge the fourth generation, they brought more capital into the company, and they really invested in the London Street store. So the familiar facade that you see now, designed by George Skipper, that was their sort of ambitious idea for making the store look much more attractive. We've got some beautiful photography from that period, which were obviously, they were sort of promoting the store, so you get advertisements for the reading library, the lending library, and then the top floor restaurant was a bit later. Well, that was during their period as well. So there were always new things developing. And
that was in the 20s?
That would have been, well, in fact, it started before the war. And then they were really ramping up in 1914. They produced, I think it was the first Christmas catalogue, which was a really lovely, we've got copies of it, and it's a really interesting catalogue to look at. But I think they've also invested quite a lot in making the environment attractive. And of course, then the war happened, and so everything was put on hold. They did manage to keep well occupied through the war, in terms of keeping the business going, and through both wars, actually. I think the people in charge at the time, they were quite determined to find work for their employees, and did so quite successfully. So there was obviously then, during the war and after the war, a bit of a hiatus, but then there were again, catalogues being produced in the early 1920s. So I think what I find fascinating, actually, looking at these catalogues, is you look at all the online sales today, and you look at mail order catalogues, and so much of it is exactly the same way of presenting the sort of terms and conditions about deliveries and all of that sort of thing. Whether other retailers were doing the same, I don't know, but I think they were always trying to be innovative. They Father Christmas came, I think, for the first time in 1914. We've got a lovely photograph of him arriving outside the store in a coach, and so many people around, the crowds are massive. So
well, I remember that growing up.
Yeah, it's not that far back, but it's the end of the whole. But yeah, exactly. Mm. I mean, it was a big thing, Father Christmas arriving at Jarrell's, and then I think lots of other Father Christmases appeared over the years and it became less of a thing. But certainly the last few years, again, it's become something rather special. And I think one of the things that's interesting is how many people have memories of doing things with their parents or grandparents. And because we're doing this work for our 250th anniversary, it's a bit ironic it's fallen in this really difficult year. We did a lot of research for the book, but we're also getting quite a lot of information from people about their memories, and we've just run a short story competition, which starting to go through the entries on that. And people, lots of the time, exchanging memories of buying their first records in Jarrell's, or going up to the restaurant and meeting their grandparents there, all that sort of thing, which is lovely that sort of still sticks in people's psyche, really.
And I think in those days, a lucky caretaker lived on site.
That's right, yes. Yeah. Well, Joe Dunham, I don't know if he was the only caretaker, but we have some wonderful photographs, actually. He lived in what was called the bungalow, which is on the roof, as it would be. And he had a garden up there, and it was a proper little house. We've still got the remnants of it. And when we do guided tours around the store, we do take people up there. I mean, you have to use your imagination somewhat, but it's lovely to have these photographs. Imagine somebody actually living up there. And it's been quite creepy, I would have thought, during night going through the darkened store. You wouldn't have the sort of lights and things that you have now. But yes, it was so, I suppose, again, when you didn't have telecommunications and things, you probably needed somebody on site and watching out for, I suppose, people breaking in, but probably even more important, watching out for fires and that sort of thing. Mm.
Do you think your forefathers would recognise Jarrell's today, or be surprised by what's happening?
I hope they'd be pleased to see that a lot of that tradition has been maintained, although the company has changed shape massively. We haven't been imprinting or publishing for over 15 years now. They were both became quite difficult industries to operate in because businesses change, and I think one of the things with the company is it has adapted and changed over the years, and sometimes quite radically. But I hope that the sort of core values are still similar to what my forebears would have recognised in terms of being a very strong part of the community, trying to, aiming to be a good employer, somewhere where people aspire to work, but also offering good quality and sort of fair value, but understanding the local market. Today, although everybody does know Jarrell's because of the department store and the other retail outlets, actually the largest part of the business is property development, which is based on the majority of that's on the Whitefriars site, which is now developing to have a mix of high quality offices and now some more housing as well. So although it's a sort of quieter, less visible part of the business, it's actually a very important part of it. And we also have a training division which grew out of what was our office equipment division many years ago, and that became very, very competitive, the whole office equipment market. But the sort of fledgling training side was taken out of that, and that's actually run by my cousin Susie now, and it's developed to being probably the largest training provider in the county. Again, it's something that not many people would notice, and they think, well, perhaps you just do the training in-house, but actually there are a lot of businesses locally which use our training facilities.
And we've been hurled into a period of very rapid change, haven't we? Which hasn't been of our choosing. Can you see any further development for retail, or which way retail is going to go?
I think it's incredibly difficult to say. Everybody will know how the high street has been quite challenging for many years now, since particularly the advent of the internet and the rise of Amazon and the convenience of shopping online. So the challenges have been accelerated really by what's happened recently with the COVID-19 situation. I mean, at the moment, I think Norwich is doing reasonably well. If you go into the city, you see quite a lot of people around. One hopes that you can weather the storm. It's just precisely at this moment in, where are we, September 2020, it's very difficult to know what the next few months are going to bring. So the business is being very carefully managed, a lot of control on costs, caution about getting the balance right between the costs and the opening hours and the amount of merchandise available, gradually opening more of the restaurants. One just hopes that that works and it can continue and that we don't get another lockdown, because I think it's going to be difficult for many, many companies, including our own. You have to reflect on what you're actually trying to achieve. It's very difficult, but one just hopes that, having pulled through an awful lot of things in the past, that the company will manage to do that again.
There certainly does seem a theme of diversification and adaptation throughout the...
Yes, and I think that and the fact that there's been a sort of constant family interest and involvement, have, that's what's seen the company through, really. And I think with a company like this, you can afford to take a longer term view. It's not just about a quick return for the shareholders, but on the other hand, that is important as well. But I think each generation has adapted and changed it. So although some parts will be familiar, there are other things which are completely different. And I'm trying to think of, well, it's basically the whole online stuff. And we actually do quite well online with our retail side, because that wouldn't have existed sort of 20, 25 years ago. And our expertise and emphasis in that area has grown a lot over the last few months, just because it's had to meet the market demands, really.
Well, Caroline, thank you so much for taking the time this afternoon to discuss a really interesting overview of a much-loved company in Norfolk.
Thank you very much.
Caroline was talking to Caroline Jarrold.